Well, come on, all you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books, pick up a gun. We're going to have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. Come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Man, this war's a go-go. Plenty good money to be made. Supplying the army with tools of trade. And hope and pray if they drop the bomb, they drop it on the Viet Cong. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. Come on, generals, let's move fast. Your big chance has come at last. Now you can go out, get those reds, because the only good commie is one that's dead. You know that peace can only be won when we've blown them all to kingdom come. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gate. Ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. Come on, mothers throughout the land. Pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate. Send your sons off before it's too late. You can be the first ones on your block. Have your boy come home in a box. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gate. Ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. And we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And it's a listener-supported network. They keep two streams of audio going just about 24/7. And they work really hard at this, and they deserve your support. So head on over there to freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Show them some love. Tonight, we have a varied lineup, and one of the featured things is we're going to be doing a couple of segments about Woodstock, because as most of you probably know, this past weekend was the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, so we're going to be doing that. Philip Ferrugio and Michael Annis are going to be participating with me in that part. But to open things up, we have a new guest. His name is Mike Bond. And Mike is a novelist and a very good one. I've been reading his books for a while now. Here's the review I wrote of his most recent book, which is called Goodbye Paris. I said, here's another thriller from my favorite modern writer in this genre. Mike Bond writes in the tradition of Frederick Forsyth, Eric Ambler, or Alastair MacLean, skillfully using world events as the backdrop for incredible characters to play out their stories. This book is not for the squeamish. The violence is palpable, invasive, pervasive. I'm a pacifist, and I don't believe in the relentless pursuit of world domination by Muslims, or at least I hope I don't. It's easier for me to believe that my own country is pursuing such evil goals, but books like this one threaten my worldview and make me ask myself some very difficult questions. I talked to Mike earlier today, and I'm going to play that interview for you right now. All right. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, Mike. And I'd like you to start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and this sort of novels that you write.
Well, thank you, Chuck. And thank you very much for the invitation to be on the New American Dream. I'm delighted, and I want to say hello to everyone out there. In terms of me and my novels, I think it comes in pretty, who I am comes pretty clearly through my novels. I've now published 9 novels in the book of poetry and have 3 more novels waiting in the wings. And my own background was, after I graduated from college, I spent a lot of time wandering the world on a shoestring, working a little bit to save enough money to go on to the next place. Spent a lot of time in the Himalayas and the North Africa, kind of everywhere in the world. And slowly from there eased into spending a lot of time as a war correspondent and as a human rights correspondent. And so what I try to do in my novels is to work on the basis of my own experiences in nasty places, if you wish, places that are in the midst of revolution, places that are in war, places where the suffering, human suffering from poverty and other issues is so enormous. So, I've been doing that I've been writing novels since the late 1980s and it's a frustrating thing because what you're trying to do, Chuck, is to speak for those people who do not have voices, the people who are trodden down by war or poverty or any or military regimes or hideous religions, and who have no voice. And I try to speak for them and for a better world in which they have a chance to prosper and grow. And I continue to travel the world. I spend most of my time overseas in many unpleasant places as well as many really enjoyable places like Europe and Russia and Latin America.
Well, that's quite a fascinating biography, Mike. And I didn't know that you had been doing this world traveling like that. That's really very interesting. So your most recent book, Paris, or was it? I don't remember the full title.
Goodbye, Paris.
Goodbye, Paris. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, mostly it takes place in Paris. Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, it's the product of many years of my experience in dealing again with wars and religious wars as well. And for many years, I've been involved in looking at the whole problem of Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic terrorism, and trying to determine what are the root causes of that, and how can we alleviate it? How can we find a way to live more peacefully in the world? Recently, somebody counted up the number of wars in the world, and there were over 40 of them, and all except one involved Islamic fundamentalism. So whether we like it or not, we have to separate our respect for a religion from those fundamentalist or terrorist aspects of a religion that render that part of it dangerous. So what Goodbye Paris is about, Chuck, is there have been, historically in the last few years, there have been 7 attempts by Islamic fundamentalists to knock down the Eiffel Tower. The first was in 1996 when they basically hijacked an Air France Airbus in Algeria with the intent to fly it into the tower. They had to stop in Marseille, and they were held in Marseille for 4 days, and then finally the French commandos stormed the plane. And after the after the terrorists began executing people. And there have been six other attempts since then. And so what Goodbye Paris is just a kind of a, it's a novel based on my own years of experience with French and American intelligence. It's a novel based on what would happen if one of these attempts was successful. And it involves, the novel involves a special forces hero named Pono Hawkins, who's a former jailbird and surfer as well as a special forces guy, and who has very deep connections with the United States as well as with France. And so he's been brought over, or he comes over to Paris because he is the only person left alive who can identify the terrorist behind this planned attack. So I've lived a good part of my life in Paris. I love it very much. So I'm able to imbue the book with a lot of local color, if you wish, the way people really are in France, as well as with the catastrophe that just happened at the Cathedral of Notre Dame, which is probably, without doubt, the most... we've had many destructions of great architecture during the last few years, most done by ISIS in the Middle East. But the loss of a great part of the Cathedral of Notre Dame is probably going to be the most destructive archaeological or artistic or architectural tragedy of the last century. So I bring that into Chuck as well.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I have been to Paris only once. I was I don't know, 9 or 10 years old, so that was, that would put it in early 60s. And you know, when I was that age, I mean, it was wonderful getting to see all of the great buildings. And I definitely remember Notre Dame, but you know, at that age, basically I was like counting the number of steps that it got to the top of everything and deciding from that which one was really the tallest. You know, kid stuff.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's the way kids are. Yeah.
Anyway, it is a huge loss. The local color that you provided was incredible, and I like Pono as a hero. This was not the first novel with Pono. I have tended to think that ISIS was, you know, a creation of the CIA and maybe not, you know, so real, but I almost changed my opinion from reading your novel.
Yeah, I can promise you, Chuck, that it's real. The first war I was into was way back when I was a kid, back in 1962 in Algeria, and it involved Islamic fundamentalists against the French at the end of the Algerian revolution, if you wish. And I've probably been in 10 wars since then involving Islamic forces on one side and non-Islamic forces on the other. And we the Americans, have many sins to account for. I'm not glossing over that. For instance, the first Iraq invasion was not necessary at all. I'm talking about the senior Bush, George Bush, when he was president. His coming into Iraq, we tricked the Iraqis into invading Kuwait and then pounced on them. But the second one, how we did that is that our ambassador to Iraq told Saddam Hussein that in the previous years and previous centuries, Iraq was the center of a huge empire, and that if this is actually in the cables and in the diplomatic cables, and that if Iraq were to invade Kuwait, the United States would keep its distance. So once, of course, that Iraq invaded Kuwait, we jumped all over them and destroyed their military, which was the goal all along. In the second Iraq invasion in 2003, was purely criminal. It was there were no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever. The entire invasion was entirely uncalled for. So we have been, and basically since oil was discovered in the Middle East, so we're going back a long way. The United States, Britain, and France principally have been involved in interfering with Middle East politics ever since. So it's not as if we are free of sin in this matter. We have we have messed with the Middle East and with Middle Eastern politics for well over 100 years. However, on the other side, there is no doubt whatsoever that some of the extremely hostile, homicidal Islamic groups are real. I mean, Al-Qaeda, for instance, was real. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. What the Taliban has done in Afghanistan is atrocious. I mean, when I was first in Afghanistan in the 1970s, that's how long ago it was, but back then, the girls wore Levi's and listened to Elvis Presley on their little transistor radios. And now the women are all covered up in black and not allowed out of the house without a man, and can be killed if they look through their burqa at another man. So and ISIS is as bad as Al Qaeda. So there's no doubt about the fact that there is a certain homicidal side to Islam, because as you know, Islam is divided. When you speak to a Muslim, they will tell you that Islam, the world of Islam, is divided into two parts. One is the House of Islam, and the other is called the House of War. And the House of War is everyone who is not a Muslim belongs in the House of War. And the job of all good Muslims is, first of all, to kill the Jews, and secondly, then to kill everyone else. So we are dealing with a serious and dangerous force, and it's extremely important that we don't minimize it or pretend it's not there, because we leave ourselves defenseless. And the other thing we do by pretending that Islamic fundamentalism is not a danger is we give it free rein to take over all of Islam. So in many countries that were moderate 20 years ago, are now under the yoke of fundamentalist Islam, and it's pretty bad. When you look at places like Saudi Arabia, for instance, or Iran, oftentimes they kill 30 to 40 people a day, execute them as supposed criminals or people who don't follow the rules the way they're supposed to. And of course, to be gay, there are 27 Islamic, all 27, let me put it this way, there are 27 countries in the world in which to be gay is to risk being executed. It's being gay is punishable by execution, and often that is the case. And all 27 of those countries are Muslim. So, in terms of,
I thought there were some Christian countries in Africa where it's just about as bad for gays.
That very well may be, but. Not to my knowledge. I've spent a lot of time in Africa, and there are some, you know, it's, and again, Christianity in Africa is different than it might be in Europe or the United States.
Yeah,
but it's, to my knowledge, I'm sorry. Please.
No, that's okay. I think it is very different in Africa. Anyway, we will, I think I'm going to have you back on to talk about some more things, because we're just about out of time right now. But this was really an eye opener. I very much appreciate having you on the show, And before we sign off, can you please tell the listeners where to find your novels?
Thank you. I'd be happy to. My website is MikeBondBooks.com. And if you go on the website, you can look at all of the books. And there's also ways to purchase them. You can purchase them through indie bookstores as well as through the major major marketers like Barnes & Noble and Amazon. You can also go to Amazon directly, where they're having a sale now of my books. And that's the best way. And also, you can go to my website, Mike Bond Books, and leave a comment, and I will get back to you. If you have a question, you have a thought that you want to share with me, I respond almost always the same day to anybody who writes in with a comment. So that's available too. And I just want to say in parting, Chuck, I want to say thank you for having me on the show. If I want to leave everyone with a message, is that we're basically all the same and we want the same thing out of life. We just have to work better together to get there.
Well, that's a wonderful message and a good note to sign off. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chuck, and my best to everyone out there.
Well, I am. I look forward to having Mike Bond on as a regular guest on the show on the fourth Thursday of every month from here on. That was certainly a great start for his New American Dream career, as it were. All right, talk to you on the other side of the station break.
Find some comfort at Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Hang in there, Phil.
Okay. Oh, shit.
I'm doing my radio show. I'll call you back.
Well, this next half hour of our show will feature Philip Ferrugio. And we're going to be starting off with a column that Philip wrote. It's a pretty good one, all about Woodstock.
All right, good evening, Working Stiffs. You know, the Woodstock Summer of Love, boy, goodness, how 50 years seem to go by like a blink in the eye of memory. Almost to the day, two sets of events harnessed the attention of our nation in August of 1969. On August 9th and 10th, what was later found out to be the work of Charles Manson's crew of hypnotic, hepped-up, hippie-dippies, Sharon Tate, the fetus inside of her, and friends, was savagely murdered. The next night, Lino LaBianca and his wife were also savagely murdered. A mere 5 days later, in an appropriately named Bethel, New York, the Woodstock Musical Festival began. Hundreds of thousands of young people spent 4 days and nights in joyous communion with each other, listening to some of the best music groups around, with no violence. Meanwhile, this was perhaps the height of the Vietnam War, with two guys from my Brooklyn neighborhood coming home in caskets. To a 19-year-old like yours truly, my naivety was expressed in only being concerned with girls, 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 along with some good pot and great music albums. Within one short year, that all changed with Nixon's illegal bombing and invasion of sovereign Cambodia and the shootings of four protesting students at Kent State University by National Guard troops. Yes, those were truly the dog days of summer, that August of 69. My sweet street smarts were actually fine-tuned by becoming a yellow cab driver during my summer break from college. Driving the day shift in Brooklyn and Manhattan revealed so much to me. Like Travis Bickle in the film Taxi Driver, the smell and sense of the Big Apple was eye and ear-opening. From the businessmen in Manhattan to the hookers going from score to score to the blue-collar working stiffs of Brooklyn, this talkative young man learned so much about people. It seemed that all the current issues of that heated summer came to the forefront of taxicab conversations. Of course, with the debacle of the Tet Offensive in 1968, when the Viet Cong attacked cities in the South and almost took Saigon itself, public opinion was changing rapidly. Yet, too many of my fellow citizens still held the flag close to their hearts and minds as they believed the lies and BS that the government threw their way. It seemed to matter not whether it be a Democrat, President Johnson, or the newly installed Republican, President Nixon, who called the shots. Or should I say, followed the lead of the military-industrial empire. To them, all the dominoes were falling into one another as this Cold War kept getting hotter. A girl I dated, Maureen D., had this dad, a Brooklyn bartender, an ex-Marine, who would lecture me each time I went to pick her up. He was lobbying me to go out and join the good fight with his crew-cut hair and proverbial beer in hand while watching Lawrence Welk. Maureen did not last long as my latest chick because she had the same mindset as her dad. Each afternoon, after I switched over to the night shift at the cab garage, the yard was filled with drivers waiting for the day shift cab to return. If ever there was a complete educational experience, far surpassing anything one learned in college, this was it. The guys a few years older than myself seemed to be mostly, not always the case, but mostly of the anti-war mindset. Most of the older cabbies, again, not all, but mostly, were on the side of Nixon and his war. The daily papers had both Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin's daily columns, and many times they centered on the Vietnam War or tentacles of it affecting New York City life. Loud and sometimes boisterous arguments ensued, with shouts of "commie bastard" and "Nixon sucks" shooting back and forth. Exactly 1 year later, this writer would participate in those same discussions. But in August of 69, I just sat and I listened. Again, my chief concern at that time was to earn enough bread to spend on girls, pot, and discos, not always in that order. The war could wait because selfishly I had that student deferment. They say that as things change, nothing changes. 50 years later, and the only thing that changes is the music on the radio. The phony wars are constant, and the mindset of many are still like Maureen's dad. The license plates celebrating the military are plentiful, as are the flags held hostage hanging from garages and lapels. New presidents speak the same language as the old ones. Of course, the one guy who decided to stand up to the empire got blown away in Dallas, but that's fodder for another column. The wrong people are elected to Congress and, of course, the White House, mostly serving the empire. And all we baby boomers who still care have to comfort us is that music from Woodstock and elsewhere. So sad. Thank you.
And now we have Philip live and in person. Welcome to the show.
As John Lennon would say, heavy, heavy, heavy.
Yeah.
yeah, that was a lot to cover in one column. But basically, Chuck, I think you and I are a few years apart, but I'm really curious to know, how did you feel during that August of 69, if you remember, with the Sharon Tate murders and then Woodstock and, of course, the Vietnam War? What were you doing? How did you feel?
What was I doing? Well, starting in 67, I guess, the fall of 67, I was at Friends Central School in Philadelphia. And the school actually sponsored bus trips down to Washington, D.C. for several of the marches on Washington. So I was very definitely, protesting at that time.
Really?
I used to go around with the buttons all over my my clothes, make love, not war. Okay. Nixon, pull out like your father should have.
I like the one of the woman, of the pregnant girl in the old like peasant dress. You know, the girl, the young like hippie type girl with the peasant dress, and underneath it says Nixon's the one. Because that was his campaign slogan. You remember Nixon's the one back in 1960. Yeah, back in 1960, yep. Nixon's the one. So you were at the French school. Do you remember the Sharon Tate murders at all?
I do. Ever
hearing of it?
I remember hearing of it. Being horrified, but I'm not sure what I really thought of it at that time, other than that it was, just a horrible thing.
Yeah, I remember hearing of it, and again, I was in college. I was driving a cab for the summer. August was very hot in New York. It was a hot August, and there was a lot of demonstrations. I didn't participate in them, like I said, for my piece. in 69, I was still not really well educated in what was really happening around me. You know, I was kind of observing. I was in an observing stage, driving a cab and meeting all kinds of people, and you know, just hearing about the demonstrations and mostly in Manhattan. You know, because I lived in Brooklyn. The anti-war demonstrations were getting more and more in 69. There was a lot of them. Don't forget, this is a year after you know, Robert King got killed April of 68. And then in June, when I was first, I was never really into politics at all, you know, up until that point. And right. I still wasn't really into it in 68. I really wasn't. But I could just see how this guy, Robert Kennedy, was getting so popular, you know, among a lot of young people in my college, Brooklyn College. There was a lot of kids for Eugene McCarthy, a lot of kids for Robert Kennedy afterwards. And I wasn't involved in that, but I could see the energy was getting really, really, really heightened. And then, of course, in June, I think it was June 4th, if I'm correct, he was assassinated, you know, after the California primary. And that was a downer, you know, after King got killed, like, in April. Yeah. So, you know, it was a really, I mean, 69, to me, well, 68 and 69, those 2 years were the most transformative years, I would say, after World War II. They were the most transformative years, 68 and 69, you know? It was just something else, yeah.
Yeah, that's quite possible.
Okay, Woodstock.
Yeah, Woodstock.
Go ahead.
One more thing before Woodstock. I think one thing that happened in the 60s, we actually almost got used to having famous people assassinated. And that was a big change.
John Kennedy assassination. Of course, you were, you know, a couple of years younger than me, but I was like 12, I think, or 13.
Yeah,
and
I was in sixth grade when Kennedy was assassinated.
I was in ninth grade, I believe.
Yeah,
and, it was terrible.
Two, 3 years. Yeah,
yeah, it was really terrible. And of course, you know, we all bought the fake news. Okay, of Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, that he did it and the whole thing, you know, single gunman and all that crap. And, of course, it was 67, actually. I guess it's important to bring this up to people listening. It was in 67 when I read the Playboy interview with Jim Garrison. Playboy had great interviews in their magazine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Jim Garrison interview about the trail of the assassins, you know, and the whole thing that he was doing there with... you know, Clay Shaw, and the trial of Clay Shaw and everything. So that was pretty, that was enlightening to me in 67. But I still did not get politicized until 1970. So 69, the summer, you know, I was a spectator. I really was. I was just a spectator. Now, okay, Woodstock. I had my first love in June of 69, and she was my age, and she was gorgeous. She was from California. I met her at the airport here in New York, and she was going to stay with her grandmother, and she was telling me that her mother was married 5 times.
Huh.
You know, I mean, the girl's real mother in California, and she was a cocktail, you know, she was a dancer. She was a nude dancer in California, the girl that I met. Yeah, so she was kind of wild in her own way. And I was, you know, I was kind of more stable. You know, I lived with my parents. I drove a cab for the summer. I went to college. Anyway, so that was my first love. It lasted June 15th till, I guess, really right around the beginning of August. The beginning of August, maybe the end of July. She broke up with me. She was cheating on me with a cop that lived in her in the area where she lived. Yeah, he was about 25, and you know, she was 19. I was 19. So anyway, I was heartbroken, and I guess things, I don't know. I think anyway, by the second week or the first week of August, I was already, I met some other girl in the neighborhood, and I wanted to go to Woodstock. And I asked her to go with me, and she said, yeah, I'll go. And I was going to get tickets, to go to Woodstock with her, because I didn't know it was going to be what happened. I thought it was just going to be like a festival, like a music concert,
yeah, right?
That type of
yeah.
thing. Yeah. So I was going to get the tickets, and then she backed out. She backed out, and I didn't get the tickets. I didn't go. And I'm glad I didn't go because, I don't know, being a Capricorn with Mars and Saturn over in Virgo, I don't think I could deal with all those crowds and sleeping outside and sleeping outside,
man,
and not bathing and not taking a shower. And, couldn't deal with
you,
it.
Bill, I really wish I'd been able to go. I would have loved to be there.
So you would have loved to just be out there and with all free love and free drugs and everything.
I probably wouldn't have actually managed much of the free love part, but that just never really worked out for me back then. But we won't say anything about the rest.
But you wouldn't mind like not that being able to shower for 2 or 3 days and sleeping outside.
I would have lived with it. It would have been fine. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad that I didn't go to the concert. Especially when I heard they closed the New York State Thruway, and it was like 300,000 people
there. I know, they closed
the
New York State Thruway, man.
Right. That was Arlo Guthrie made the announcement, you remember?
That's right.
At Woodstock. He's, hey, man, they closed the New York State Thruway, man. Yeah. But anyway, but it's funny, all these things happened. I mean, think about it, Chuck. All these things happened in the month of August. I mean, you had the Tate and LaBianca, murders, cold-blooded. I mean, she was pregnant. She had a baby in her, and they slashed her. Like, it was horrible, the whole story.
Yeah.
And it was in all the papers, and then 5 days later was the Woodstock, festival.
Yeah.
Nobody knew it was going to be.
And don't forget about the moon landing was right in there too.
The moon landing was back in July.
It
was back in July.
A month away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
A month before. They had the moon landing. Right.
Yeah.
So you had all these things happening in that summer. Plus, you had the Vietnam, all these anti-war demonstrations. I mean, I remember. I didn't put this in the column because I didn't know, Chuck, if it happened in 69 or in 70. So I didn't want to, but
okay.
I remember a guy, I lived on a street in Brooklyn, Brooklyn, New York, in a, what they call like a neighborhood, two family homes, one next to the other. And it was, I'm into urban, real urban. And we used to hang out on the street corner in the summer because it was so hot at night. All the guys would hang out and till like 11:30 at night, and then we all go home to sleep. But there was a guy there that was a fire marshal, and he was 32 years old. He was 13 years older than me, and he was like the older rabbi of our little group. He would tell us all the stories about all the women he had and experiences. He was like one of those type. But he was a nice guy, and we'd all get a couple. I remember we'd all get beers. We stand on the corner drinking beer and talking on the hot nights. Well, one of the guys from the street was a guy named Gus, and he was a dental student. And he came over to us one night. He just came home. He was going to NYU Dental School in Manhattan, and he came home that night late, and he was telling us a story that there was a big anti-war demonstration, like a rally, right near his school. And the construction workers just went down and beat the hell out of the people who were anti-war protesters. The construction workers in uniform, the guys were all working.
Right.
And there was a riot, and they were beaten. He said that all the students were acting like MDs. They were helping the people that were beat up in the streets. They actually went out to the streets, and they were trying to help these people who got beaten up by the construction workers. Uh-huh. And he was really pissed off. he was really pissed off. I mean, he came home and he was telling us about it, and he was full of passion. Well, the fire marshal, Don, he was obviously pro-Nixon, pro-war, you know, he was 32 years old. He said, yo, I served my time, too. I was in, he said, don't forget, we were marching on the sands of Coney Island. We didn't know if we were going to go over to Lebanon back in 57 or something like that. You know, give me a break, will you? He was worried. They were worried about going over to Lebanon in 57 or something. You know, So anyway, he was pro-Nixon, pro-war and all that stuff. And, you know, Gus and him got into a heated argument on the corner. I mean, they almost came to blows. You know, it was really getting really heavy. You know, we had to step in there and try to break it up. But that's wow. That was the energy that was in happening at that time. You know, it was powerful.
It was. It
was powerful energy, and you know, and I think that's why a lot of people my age at that time smoked pot. Really, I'm serious, because there was so much happening. You know, President Nixon as a president, and, you know, it was very reactionary government, and the Vietnam thing was just really bad. You know, Robert Kennedy gets killed the year before, assassinated.
Yeah.
It was a heavy, heavy time. Yeah, it was a heavy time. And you had a couple of things that you could be insulated with. And one was music, and the other was pot. You know, you smoke pot, yeah. And you kind of laugh, you know. That's what we did, you know. We smoked pot just to relax and just to laugh at everything, because it was so crazy. I mean,
indeed.
That girl I dated, that's a real story. I mean, her father, you know, he was an ex-Marine, and
yeah.
Now he's a bartender. You know, he wasn't a bad guy, you know. He was a nice man.
Right.
But, God, this guy was, I mean, I could see him now. If he was the same age he was then, now, I could see him, like, you know, supporting the Charlottesville March.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
I mean, the white supremacist. Yeah.
Wow.
I could see him saying that, well, you know, those people have a right, you know, they have a gripe, you know. You know, really, I mean, this is what's happening now, Chuck, 50 years later. Well, tell me what you feel about that.
Well, I think 50 years later, we still have a lot of the same issues. You know, we thought we won back then. You know, we protesters or whatever. We thought, hey, we got the war stopped. We got all these civil rights legislation passed. We made such a difference. Okay, let's just sit back and enjoy it now for the rest of our lives. And you know what? That didn't work out so well, because nothing really changed. I mean, things changed on the surface, but what was underneath was still there. And for many years, it was buried, hidden, and in some ways, even more insidious than now when it's back out in the open. But
it
has been there. It's horrible.
I'm driving behind a truck, a pickup truck. You know, I'm in Central Florida. Okay,
yeah.
Not Central. That's where I live. So I'm driving behind a pickup truck, a black pickup truck. I can't see the guy because his windows are all like blacked out, whatever you call it. And on the back of the truck, he has a teepee figure, you know. On top of it says pro-God. On the left side, it says pro-life. On the right side, it says pro-guns. And on the bottom, it says pro-American. And his license is Bear Arms. Okay?
Wow.
So this is indicative of the mindset of people nowadays, a lot of people nowadays.
Yeah.
I had lunch with a guy, a wonderful guy, who's a native from Floridian, lived here his whole life. He's in the financial industry. You know, he has a very good, very bright guy and a nice guy. He's in his early 60s, and he's telling me that his father was a lawyer, you know, and he said that growing up, that in his house they referred to black people. His father referred to black. His father was a very well-educated, you know, lawyer, but yeah, he referred to black people as niggers.
Yeah,
that was just the way they spoke. He said that's how people talked amongst themselves. You know, and it's weird to hear that because, and he said it. He claims, you know, and I believe him. His father was not didn't do anything against black people his whole life. He was a good lawyer, and he cared, you know. But that's the way his father was raised.
Yeah,
you know, in the South, that they just, that's how they referred to black people. And I know a woman who grew up in the Midwest, and her father was a German American worker, and he always called them niggers. Black people were niggers to him.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's just, and they said it in a very matter of fact way, and that's the mindset. And I think the mindset's coming out again. It's coming up. It's coming to the surface.
Exactly, it is coming to the surface. And I hope something happens to make it go away entirely this time.
Yeah. It is scary. It is scary.
It is very scary. It scares the you know what out of me. Anyway, our time is up. I really enjoyed this discussion with you, Phil, and I'd like to thank you again for you know, being with me on this show. And I hope that our listeners will go looking for you on the internet. Just Google Philip Ferrugio. That's Ferrugio, and you'll find a ton of great articles that he puts out. Pretty much one a week, and just go look it. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you so much, Chuck. I appreciate for being on.
All right.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship. Or be quiet. Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship. You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth. You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Ohio Exopolitics will be on from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A. Mark Steiner will have guests on that will discuss many important topics, including the state of the world today. However, much of the show will be dedicated to the writings of Edward Albert Meyer. Let me read a short passage from one of his writings. Love is the highest principle of creation, and through it, everything exists in absolute logic. All of nature in its indescribable splendor is nothing but the love of creation, which is expressed visibly. The love of creation is everywhere, because without it, nothing at all would be able to exist. Please join Mark on Ohio Exopolitics from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne, and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, welcome back to the New American Dream Radio Show, everyone. And in this segment, we are going to continue the theme of Woodstock. We're going to bring Michael Annis to the show. I'm trying to call him right about now. And Michael has been a regular guest for us for quite some time. He is a publisher, a poet, a musician, a fascinating guy, and we're very lucky to have him on the show, and we're calling him right about now. Michael is the publisher of Howling Dog Press.
Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. It's Chuck Gregory, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your essay about Woodstock.
Well, to be clear, this is not exactly an essay about Woodstock. What it is a... Well, okay, let me begin here. So,
okay.
Acknowledging that all living things on this planet via climate change are now entering into dark, uncharted waters, and I think of the film Apocalypse Now when I say that, or like some absurd science fiction documentary of the human race in complete denial, ignoring the imminent doom, with a band playing Dixie on the Deck and the Star-Spangled Banner sung by Cardi B as the Titanic crumbles and capsizes into the iceberg. So now for something completely different, as the ship shears apart and we collapse into psychic ruination, tonight I'll read what I deem a mirror held up to Woodstock that is titled, Welcome to the Future. And it begins with a short quote. After I finished this, I was listening to Phil and you on the air, and after I finished this piece, I may have a couple, if there's time, I might have a couple of anecdotes myself. to tell about that time period, which are they cohere with some of what Chuck was saying, or Film was saying. But first, this essay. Welcome to the future, end the quote. The empires of the future are empires of the mind. Winston Churchill. And the last thing we want to do per light, love, and life is to occupy it, particularly under the false, ego-swelling pretense that it's our empire, our invention, our creation. So let us futurelings desire to cohabit in harmony within it, this hive mind of human civilization. Inhabiting the future, fully in cognition, identifying it as human identity beyond the borders of our intellect, our presuppositions, and far beyond an anti-spirit seeking to conquer the future as we have convinced ourselves that we have conquered and occupied the past, where what we begin to realize through inhabitation is that the future is the almighty present. Welcome to the future present paradox. Welcome to the expanding, contracting breath of the experience of now, 1 second's evolution into itself eternally. It's a place we belong, this future. It is the place where we fully manifest immortality through complete integration of now. It's the Christos blossoming wings on human bodies, transforming them from this semi-inhabitable biological density to that which is greater, more fully realized, actualized, conducive to life, immortal. Welcome to manifesting as alien in this world gone mad with greed, conquest, power, where simply by your presence you transform it. Welcome to now, O alien, who brought the future to Earth, who saw perfection that is now, incarnating it continually, beyond geographical borders, beyond gender, beyond species, or an old paradigm, Homo sapiens, is proven to be poorly realized, poorly initiated, poorly self-actualized, where the future fills itself with each moment, fully lived, fully being, where the human mind comprehends that it has always been so, where synapses integrating from being to being have finally expanded to realize it. Welcome to the place where the old worn-out prejudices no longer suffice, and new prejudices are continuously manufactured to replace them. Now where clichés of living are seen as mass-destructive, where humans are inoculated at birth against redundancies, triteness, and rut-wearing, habitual, bigoted, superstitious eventualities. Welcome to the future, where poets are lawmakers, creating laws from the magic of compassion and deep piercing vision and love, where artists are legislators of let there become, to bring forth limitless horizons and profound alternatives to a world previously run on the sludge faith and fuels of greed, jealousy, violence, conquests, and armies enlisted to the last drop of blood to serve up mass murder for the magus of money. This place we shall now inhabit is one of rebuilt and reconstructed human identity, tolerant only of that which benefits all, including the bag lady and the indigenous peoples. Welcome to the timeless, placeless, where empires do not exist, where conquest is outlawed, for the empires of old prove to be consistently, completely self-serving entities of mass pandemics and catastrophic devastations. Welcome to churn world, O sojourner, where reinvention is a bulwark against stagnation and business as usual. Where the Popes of Liverpool have histories and discographies that belie parodies of the scatological world of anti-fantasy. Where those seeking to control and confiscate the future are too occupied, attempting to figure out what it is and why it won't stay where they thought they had either banished or imprisoned it. Where innovation, articulation, and reinventing the reinvention of the living language of awe thrives, relying on breadth of experience, chaos unspooling, and ingenuity, rather than on badges and medals of approval for rampant acquiescence. Where one cannot ever be persuaded to become fertilizer for convention to feed the forests of injustice and the seas of tyranny. Where one's foresight is as great as one's hindsight. Where an intellectual outlaw is to be freed from the compound of the mordant laws of war, strife, and spiritual bloodshed. An outlaw gifted with the genius of birthing beauty, compassion, and earth-shaking peace. Where poetry declares a universe beyond the omnipotence of self, creates the omniscience of humanity transcending self to become omnipresent in space and time. While everlasting in ignited spark of inner divinity and the raging flames of universal specieshood, emitting the hate-blinding light of universal love. The future welcomed is time, which is timelessness. And time is man in his youth drinking too much wine, terrified to glance out into the night sky. For each glance taken, he feels the stars yanking his soul out of his body. Then suddenly, simultaneously, he stares back from the stars, witnessing himself as an old man, composing these very lines, believing their time has finally come. The future is eons of unfolding mythology compressed into a single moment we know as now, a timelessness sequentially organized into an abstract expansionism of categories known as milliseconds, seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades, centennia, millennia, eons, ages, internal and external eternity, in a great, randomly stratified, single unified theory we recognize as now. While each moment is the future, and every moment becomes the past, and the present is an abstract theory, the back-to-back faces of Janus in opposition to the central core of immediate realization. Welcome to the lost civilizations of the future, where Homo sapiens no longer inhabit the earth, and the earth is evolving on a journey hurtling toward a distant, all-engulfing sun, Sol Apollo having burned out a billion years past, rekindled in the abstractions of physics, mathematics, and musics, where all that is abstracted concrete is caught in the blink of an eye of a meth head crashed meth head first into the concrete curb of a sidewalk on 14th Street in Lower Manhattan, his third eye coursing up along the finely stockinged lines of ankles, calves, knees, thighs, ass, his imagination running in place behind a parked car, glaring at his future prison handiwork, the license plate with its sundry prophetic interpretations, writing the screenplay of his life within which he steals the purse of this co-ed, sultrily making her way toward a glass, steel, concrete office temple at the southern tip of the island, where the soot and ashes of the phoenix of civilization chant Omar Khayyam's litany. We are the last, the only one. Anxiously anticipating our future state of being as completely fertilized eggs. Welcome to the quantum human point of the neural electric universe, remembering the future, the pulsating directional shift as his eye follows the demarcating dashed arrow across the foamy expanse of water to the erection of liberty, frozen in the meltdown of decay, its parishioners weaving along the gutters, trailing their rusting shopping carts, collecting abandoned shoes left by mystic butt-smoking winos of long decomposed poems, tongues hanging out the sides of their mouths, dribbling saliva as they combed for dumpster treasures. All the dreams and nightmares that infest the future with hope and despair, its generational breadth of experience in the collaboration of arts and literature, spontaneously combusting mutual enhancement in ejaculations of explosive karma, expanding both forms to become greater than individually experienced. Until the architecture of human consciousness transcends itself, and our transfiguration into a higher life form completes the journey, what is completion in the ever-expanding wiles of DNA, I muse. Until then, human future is imprisoned in human past. The tools for this migration are new languages and new vision that impact human DNA, to jettison the conch-like processes and philosophies of entrapment, imprisoning the human supermind in the shell of mortality. Through the living languages of science, literature, music, and art, we genetic breatharians create godlike genetic paradigms to unwind and reveal new starscapes of DNA, transfiguring itself in a simple equation, minus the rebuilding reconstruction of human identity, the trillion-petaled lotus of personalities traveling the psychically unraveled creation of ever-expanding human archetype and architectures, the future welcomed is doomed, relegated to more of the past, and scorned as animism. What is the identity of the shared mind, the collective psyche? From where does collective consciousness evolve of love? Has it always existed, always recognized itself in the mirror of never-changing reality of ever-changing identity? To evolve, or to have love as a single strand of DNA, seeking that elusive other strand, that quanta in the infinite neural network of the universal human genome. Is the network not infinite? And if then, are we not gods, sharing godhood with the infinite, absolute, ultimate intelligence? Do you not see the shades and permutations of the infinite present in the works of artists throughout past and present centuries, both visual and literary, of dance, mime, and music? Do you not hear the cantoed voices of the ever-present future in the lines and assembly-disassembly of words of the poets of all races, all nations, even all planets? The elusive, embracing currents of pathfinders in the shamanic arts. Who is Neanderthal? Who Cro-Magnon? Who is Picasso? Who Turcotte? Who is Mozart? Who Mukhovets? Who is Dostoevsky? Who Soriano? Who is Hemingway? Who Avedon? Who Levinson? Who is Herzog? Who is Musco? Who Palachek? Each reinvention of the great human voyage on the good ship being churns across the raging space-time continuum of the human genome, human destiny. Flying dreams blazing forth in language, ironically extinguishing the fiery walls between past, present, future, to proclaim the eternal now of the infinite Godhead, the hive mind of I Am, and thus, reinventing the reinventions, welcome the omnipresent future, where the backwaters and eddies of a churning world weave art and literature into the language of a single unified theory. Phenomenal, astounding, astonishing, spectral, extrasensory, phantasmagorical, a future swirling and staggering present superlatives, an ever-expanding net harvesting stars of creative cultural intelligence illuminating the ulterior universe of parallel reality where time is a five-dimensional black hole regurgitating human wormholes to other worlds, and the vortex known as Homo sapiens transcends time itself to become Homo Christos. Anti-gravity, teleportation, dematerialization, AI, time travel, fusion, identity transmutation, the anthropolatry of hive mind, and the hive mind is now. Psychic chaos spooling out from the core of the universe, from the nexus of time and eternity, not to occupy through oppression, but to inhabit fully, peacefully so, parallel existences in the singularity known as consciousness, in the amalgamation imagined as the multiverse, here, upon the third rock from nowhere, where parties rage in disease, war, poverty, starvation, and a few fat cats and their mistresses having the time of everyone's lives. Now here, where the end is always near, as is the beginning, where future is running in place, stalled behind the parked car of past, where the future is always new, yet abandoned, restructured, destructured, redefined, as nothing ever repeats or resurrects the fingerprint of unique identity. Where future is hovering in place, ascending from the junkyards of past. Where future is always renewed, disinherited, while each second spans millennia. Where insurrection is forever vulcanizing a single disassembled heartbeat. In your kaleidoscopic deliquescence of incarnations. Shall you enter here? Shall you rest here? Shall you abandon despair, all ye who enter here? Welcome to the future. Ascend. You are traveling to another dimension, a Python-esque world not only of sight and sound, but of a gullible and pugnacious mind, a sojourn into a patently febrile land whose boundaries are witless consumerism. Your next stop, unknown. But the beginning is here.
Michael, that was amazing. You kept sending me off into other works by other people. I mean, I went from T.S. Eliot to Bob Dylan to Rod Serling and a whole lot of others in between. But
Rod Serling is definitely in it. And so is Monty Python, by the way.
Yeah. Really, a very fine piece. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Joe.
You have about 2.5 to 3 minutes left. If you have an anecdote for us, I'd love to hear it.
Well, just a comment first, okay? Because I've been thinking about this whole Woodstock thing, and I've been thinking about why people would think that perhaps that could be realized again. You know, the consciousness is not there. It's no longer there, and you move from that consciousness to something else. It makes no difference what destroyed it. I mean, there's ideas, there are ideas of what, but it was a series, I believe Phil got into, there's a series of events that actually culminated in the loss of that consciousness. It's out there somewhere, it's floating around. But there's a universal consciousness of both space and time, and that which potentially exists outside of both. Each generation is a component of that, adding to a facet to it, which cannot be replicated. Who can replicate consciousness? One can imitate, often poorly, but not replicate it. You can't bring back Woodstock. And it's a vanity of consciousness that believes you can. But this applies to everything, every event, every generation of human consciousness. It can be tapped into, but not brought back into being. So, I'll try to get really quick at it. I wrote, I hear this stuff about, this is the next so-and-so, this is the next Beatles, this is... So, here's the thing. Long ago, 30 years ago, I wrote a short story that where I four young Arab lads, from the Middle East, they form a band and they head to New York City introducing their band as the next Beatles. This was their connection to Western civilization. They were the next Beatles. They truly believed it in their hearts and souls. But as Robert Heinlein said in Stranger in a Strange Land, grok the moment. Pull out and understand the aspects and let it go, then contribute to the next. Okay, so, I don't know how much I have left, but probably
none.
Not.
None.
Okay. All right.
Michael, thank you so much. That was a very excellent segment, and I look forward to talking to you again next month.
Right on, Chuck. Good to be back, always.
Thanks.
All right.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist, featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
This coin, light coin, my coin, your coin, blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern, Studio A.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne, and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I have been. I really enjoyed our great guest tonight. And we've got another guest right now. We're going to hear from Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. I called Frank earlier tonight, and here's the conversation that we had. Well, hello, Frank. How are you?
Well, I'm kind of like a, I suppose, idyllic. I mean, today it's a crisp and mid-70s. We could be, you know, it's cool and not terribly humid at all. And I'm literally just sitting on a bench. We have at our Catholic Worker, the yard in the summertime. A good many of the folks we do serve just hang outdoors. It's just a lot better. So we've moved to seven picnic tables of all sorts of conditions, and they're all lined up in a way in which they get the most shade. And there's always a few people out here. It's a very casual day. I made a great meal. Tons of meat. People love meat. I know it's a bad thing. It's the worst thing you can eat. A little factoid about people who want to be, conscious about their carbon footprint. Folks who, if you, the difference between you having a Volkswagen Bug and one of those Humvees, a person eating meat. It's better for the planet that you not eat meat and go ahead and buy the Humvee. Now, can you believe that? But I'm in Iowa. I can believe that because everything we're about out here is done through oil.
Yeah.
It takes oil to bring stuff to Iowa. Because that's how transportation is all figured out. And it takes oil to get it out. And then the industry. It's a corporate agriculture. So they got this kind of science that feeds large stuff that takes oil to produce and make.
Yeah.
Oil derivatives, fertilizer, all of the energy it takes to run these things, these high contraptions. So it's a, it's just, I can see why eating a hamburger is far more dangerous to the planet than driving one of these damn Humvees. And you know how obnoxious those things look. So, yeah. Which is a great segue for what I was going to just try to reflect this time. And it's good weather gives me a better heart to do so. One of my observations is that as an older person, and I'm 68, the last few years I have become very negative. You know, I fight trying to go into just always being pessimistic. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. I'm doing it all the time. I mean, I am. Drones are killing us. It's the one, the oils, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's so patterned that people say the first word out of your mouth is empire, Frank. We all get it. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that except that if I don't find a joyful way to live in this madness, I think that's what I got to do is keep my spirits up. I'm working on that. That's what I'm doing. I listened to a guy, Matthew Fox, a former Dominican, great guy, who now has become an Episcopal priest because he was kicked out of the church for his radical theology. He was speaking about that with the progressives and the left. He says, your problem, you know, about how, where to bring religion and the spirit into the progressive left, platform. And mostly the progressive left that are church people are so depressed by how badly things are done. They have no interest in the church or the message. And that's a shame because the message is really important, the Jesus message. And this is where I get a little wacko because I always go back to that radical Jesus. I mean, really, this is a story that makes a dead Jew on a tree in the first century, which then was as common as the cold in February in Iowa, look good. Not only look good, look better than Caesar. And that his way, his ethic of, you know, there's only four major beats: unconditional love, unlimited forgiveness, radical egalitarianism, and you always start from the bottom up. Preferential option, as the church says, for the poor. That is the path. And you do that, you know, and you're going to be going against all the odds in the world. Jesus did, and the story is, it's worth it. You live forever. Uh-huh. So I got to get that back into my step. Because the truth is, Chuck, the text itself was written when their world was being destroyed completely. Everything they knew, and there was nothing to hold on to. The liquidation of that generation of Second Temple Jews, in which the birth of Christianity was formed, in between 70 and 130. That's a critical element of how to read the text. And in their world, in many ways, in the same way the one we're living in right now, we just have to find ourselves in the geography of the Gospels. And Jesus isn't with the rich, and he isn't with the people who are for wars, and he wouldn't be for the USA. I mean, really. That's the kind of the struggles I'm going through.
Well, I think in many ways we're all going through those struggles these days. I mean, it's crazy out there.
Oh my God! Yes, it really is. And how to find your base? How to find your center? So I'm for me, it's this 40-year gig with the worker, and just doing the works of mercy. It's just like, it's, if I don't get grounded here, I don't get grounded anywhere. And then I got to drink the Kool-Aid and believe. And the days I don't feel like believing, I do what a Catholics do, fake it till you make it. You know, it's just a matter of do right, even if don't feel good. Feel good is way overrated sometimes. Well, we got enough. Right. You think anyone's listening, Chuck? Do you really think anyone's listening?
I do think so. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
You really do? Really, well, you have more faith than me.
There you go.
We'll talk next week. God bless.
Thank you, Frank. God bless.
All right. Bye. Thanks, Chuck. Bye.
Always a pleasure to talk to Frank Cordero. I got to meet him in person last year, and it was really great. Okay, actually a couple of years ago. Anyway, our final guest of the evening is Julius Awafong, our columnist from Yaoundé, Cameroon. And Julius pre-records his segment for us and sends us the recording. And he told me today that for the last 2 weeks, every single day, they've lost electricity over there for about 18 hours. That doesn't leave a whole lot of time. But somehow he managed to do his recording, and he managed to get the internet to come up long enough so he could send it to me, and I'm very grateful. And here we are, Julius Awafong from Cameroon.
Sometimes the way African states behave, or some people, or some political actor or government in some African states behave, make some of us believe or think that there's much to do. In fact, there is much to do. I just read a piece of publication yesterday where the court in Gabon is a neighboring country to Cameroon in the Central African sub-region. Gabon's Court of Appeal decided that on Monday 26, they will listen to a petition filed in by the opposition seeking that the President Ali Bongo goes through a medical test to prove he has the fitness to govern. But before this petition was accepted by the court, the Ministry of Justice, after it was accepted that it would go through, the Minister of Justice suspended the judge who allowed the opposition campaigns to file this petition. So now people are asking, now that the judge has been fired, now that it is clear that the Ministry of Justice or the justice system has taken side, how will the case be heard? That is one of the things that make us, that's one of the characteristics of post-colonial African state. Sometimes they portray some such of a make-do where people believe that, or they make people believe that they are a democracy, they are promoting a democracy, there is patriotism. Meanwhile, in the real sense, there's nothing like patriotism, and that has always been my fight. Or my campaign when I talk of allowing people to self-govern themselves. Because in the real sense, patriotism does not exist in most post-colonial African states. People just want to have positions to fill their pocket. If you are referring to patriotism to mean the love for fatherland, then most African states are far from it, because most of them are showing a love for a president, a love for a leader, and not for the fatherland itself. And remember, Ali Bongo, who is the current president of Gabon, took over from his father when he died in 2009. That is about 11 years to 10, 11 years today. Ali Bongo has been sick. He was hospitalized in Morocco for over 2 months. He's paralyzed physically and mentally. He walks on crutches, and the way he walks shows that, you don't need a medical doctor to tell you that this man is not fit to govern. But why would people allow him to stay there? Or why would he be encroaching onto power when he knows fully that he's not capable of governing? It is simple to understand, to my opinion, because does he really govern? Does he even govern? That's the question. Do African leaders govern? What is the meaning of governing? What does governing mean? Governing, if it means to take care of the well-being of the people, which has so many other prerequisites, like promoting education, promoting freedom of expression, promoting the right for people to think critically and criticize critically and constructively, promoting an open debate, which are all elements of democracy. If these are the prerequisites for good governance, then these guys are not there for it, because from every indication, they don't want people to criticize them. They don't want people to say that they cannot govern, or they are weak, or they are outdated in the positions they occupy. Coming to Cameroon, another person said, the problem we are facing in Cameroon today is the President of the Republic, because he has centralized the governing apparatus. He gives more power to those who are appointed, while those who are elected have no power over the institutions of the state. And even that, those who are appointed are accountable not to the people but to him, which is very logical, because when you appoint somebody, you assign him to do a certain number of things on your behalf. Meanwhile, when the people elect like their representatives, these people are obliged, or they are accountable to the people who elected them. But now we are in a system where those who are appointed are not accountable to the people. They are accountable only to the person who appointed them. And sometimes they have to do the things to please the guy who appointed them. Now, after observing all these things, all these happenings in most of our African states, we try to understand from the point of democracy and politics. Why do people get into politics? What is democracy in Africa? First of all, it's important to understand that the notion of democracy, even though it is said originated from ancient Greece, is a deeply rooted nature in man. That's in man's innate capacity for self-government. Democracy simply means people want to govern themselves. People want to better up themselves, sometimes by taking the center stage. And this has to go through, in most African states and most states of the world, it has to go through a process which is called the democratization process. And the democratization process has some prerequisites too, which, I mean, in our modern times, like institutionalized political parties, the economic system. In fact, this was even a condition put in place by the American researcher Samuel Martin Lipset, who holds that we need a certain degree of economic and social background, that is a high per capita income, widespread literacy, the prevalence of urban residents for democracy to thrive. But in most African states, post-colonial African states, like in the Central African sub-region, the leaders do not even promote education. Yes, they will say people go to school, but why? What kind of education are you promoting? There is education and there's education. There's education to empower the people, and there's education to make the people only believe in you. I mean, not to promote their critical thinking capacity. And that's what most African leaders do. Sometimes they do not even encourage these educational systems in place, like supporting the teachers, equipping the libraries, building good structures for students to study in. Once all these things are lacking, and you only have education, or you only promote education on papers, where is that going to lead us to? Worse, we are in a third world country, in a country where the rate of unemployment is very high, the rate of poverty is very high. And with all this, the preconditions defined by Samuel Martin Lipset on a thriving democracy or a thriving democratization process is never going to happen. And this is not, sometimes people attribute it to the nature of the state, yes, which is correct, but sometimes the people themselves, those who take the center stage to promoting democracy, to promoting governance, consciously do not want it to flourish. That is why, we have this author who calls most of the African states, most like including Cameroon, bottom billion states. That's a state where you have so many people who are poor and a few who are rich. Such countries will have problems to arise, because some of them are clamped down with their or by their subnational identities, which sometimes override loyalty to the states as a the state as a whole. And this is not only found on the people on the of the grassroots; it is equally a practice put in place by the leaders. Now, with this democracy in such a context, will hardly function, because with the ethnic affiliation, which is equally promoted by these leaders, who do not want democracy, who do not want an open society where people can live healthily and freely, will always create a state where people will tend to vote according to ethnic affiliation. And those who govern the state apparatus tend to distribute resources only to their communities or to those who vote for them. In most African states, political parties, for example, who are out to promote democracy have also woefully failed, because some people join politics not because they really want to promote the well-being of the people. Some of these guys lack the commitment to the rules of democracy itself. Some of them join politics or they join political parties as a means to enrich themselves, to promote their own communities, to empower themselves and render the people poor. Now, with all this in place, we tend to understand why some leaders would not leave power. Why some people who are put in place by these leaders, I talk about those who are appointed, will tend to support these leaders and even destroy those who are elected and who criticize these leaders who don't do their jobs well. So that was it for today. I'll be back next month with more updates on Africa, and I'll be talking about Sudan and some other African states with their recent happenings. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Julius Abafong. That was really a very interesting piece. I'd like to thank all of the guests tonight. As we near the end of this edition of the New American Dream Radio Show, we had Mike Bond, Philip Ferrugio, Michael Annis, Frank Cordero, and Julius Awafong. And I tell you, I am so lucky to have these great guests to join me on this show. And I'm also very, very lucky to have all of you listening. And I thank you for listening. I hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on the New American Dream Radio Show. Remember, we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. And it's a listener-supported network. They do need your support. So thanks again. And I'm going to kind of take us out with a song, another song from Woodstock. I opened with I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag from Country Joe and the Fish. And going to end up with a little Arlo Guthrie. Coming in from London, from over the pole, flying in a big airliner, chicken flying everywhere around the plane. Could we ever feel much finer? Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags, if you please, Mr. Customs Man. There's a guy with a ticket to Mexico. No, he couldn't look much stranger. Walking in the hall with his things and all. Smiling, said he was the Lone Ranger. Coming into Los Angeles. Bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags, if you please, Mr. Customs Man. Hip woman walking on the moving floor, tripping on the escalator. There's a man in the line and she's blowing his mind, thinking that he's already made her. Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bag if you please, Mr. Customs Man. Hey. Coming in from London, from over the pole, flying in a big airliner, chicken flying everywhere around the plane. Could we ever feel much finer? Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man. Good night, everyone.
Welcome to Revolution Radio, where you, the listeners, are in charge. Here at Revolution Radio, we present 48 broadcast hours of news and information each and every day. Revolution Radio never sleeps. Revolution Radio is worldwide and borderless information. Revolution Radio is also commercial free. Revolution Radio is supported 100% by you, the listeners. And that's why we appeal to you to donate and support this station and its expenses. You can support us in many available options like archive subscriptions, our seed pack selections, or even my woodworking store. And we also even have Revolution Radio's swag at the Revolution Radio Zazzle store, in which you can get t-shirts, coffee cups, even a baby onesie. Or you can just plain donate to the cause. We cannot continue without your support, and your support is what helps pay the bills. So please, if you wish us to continue, please stop by our station support page and drop a dime on us. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. Data safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation? Is survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents. Imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank or all the banks.